Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the KE Report Weekend Show. Corey and Chad here, your hosts for this weekend edition, also your hosts on our website, podcast, and YouTube channel, highlighting day-to-day market moves and company updates. Please be sure to go back and check out all our daily editorials and company updates. This weekend show, we're going to take a step back from some of the day-to-day moves in the markets and also the day-to-day economic data that we get. Take more of a big picture look at the economy and at markets, especially in the U.S., but I'm sure we'll be talking global markets as well. We're kicking off this show with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group, also editor of the Book Report on Substack. Now, Peter, through your Substack, you send out multiple notes every day highlighting earnings calls, market moves, economic data, and really anything else that is relevant to markets and also the economy. Look, there's no denying that the economy right now is really in turmoil. No one really knows what's coming in terms of tariffs, in terms of government policy, and that's handcuffing a lot of companies and I think a lot of traders, just judging by the day-to-day volatility that we're seeing without real direction, it seems like, in markets, arguably downward bias. But Peter, your general take, if you could summarize everything that you've been sharing with your Substack subscribers, what would that takeaway be for the economy and the markets?
Certainly a high level of confusion and disarray if you're a manufacturer or a retailer or somebody who's procuring product in China and other countries. But I think it's important to look at this big picture because before even the tariffs came about, there were sort of shifts in the ground underneath us. You know, we came into the year with tech stocks driving the bus still, the AI tech trade running on all cylinders. Actually, I shouldn't say on all, on most. And the reason why I say that is because it seems like the back half of last year, investors started to sort of differentiate the AI tech trade and questioning some of the huge amounts of spend being taking place. You know, use Microsoft, for example. Coming into the year, Microsoft stock actually peaked in June of last year. And people started to view Microsoft as more of a capital intensive business instead of a free cash flowing, a robust business. And then you, of course, have the DeepSeek news late January that completely disrupted and sort of broke up, I believe, that the dominance of the Mag 7 trade. Tesla obviously had its own issues with the, focus of Elon Musk on other things and questions about the state of their auto business. And then, you know, the lack of an AI Apple intelligence upgrade cycle for Apple, and now questions about Google's reliance on search that is being disrupted, and so on and so on. The point there is that if you lose 35% of the S&P in terms of leadership, it's important to quickly find other things, because if the stock market begins to show shaky legs, you know, that can flow into the economy, because the economy has benefited from that AI tech spend, has benefited from upper income spending, where these upper income households have benefited from high values of their stock portfolio and home prices. And then, of course, anything benefiting from government spending. And then getting back to Musk, we know that anything related to government spending has also been a huge boost to economic activity. So then you throw in, of course, the tariffs and all the uncertainty that that creates in terms of one's visibility with their business, particularly if they are part of the global supply chain, whether they're buyers of it or suppliers into it. And that has caused, obviously, a lot of angst. You know, there's one thing to say, okay, we're going to raise tariffs on this and that over a 12-month time period, where businesses would be able to sort of plan around that, instead of, okay, we're going to raise your tax to 145% next week, go deal with it. You know, those are two completely different things. And granted, we've taken off for 90 days the reciprocal tariffs that mature on July 9th, and versus the uncertainty now with how the Chinese negotiations are going to go. But that's no way to run an economy. That's no way to disrupt small businesses in particular, who just don't have the ability to quickly maneuver and adjust under that circumstance. So the odds certainly are growing for an economic downturn. I think a big part of that sort of question will be how the stock market deals with this from here on out in the sense of influencing upper income spending. My point there is that if the stock market breaks down again and we retest that 5,000, 4,800 level and break below and don't have a quick snapback, then that would dramatically raise the odds of an economic downturn. So a lot of balls in the air here, unfortunately, a lot self-inflicted, but the days of the US market commanding 22 times multiples on a forward basis, the days of seven stocks leading the way without any help from other parts of the market, I think are over. Investors are luckily, though, finding other things to buy, whether it's domestically or internationally. I just think that there's a transition phase that we're in the midst of here with obviously major economic disruption risks, like I just laid out.
Yeah, Peter, I think that's a great summary. And you were early on the case, even last year, talking about the huge spend into AI and tech companies, but maybe not the profitability on the other side of that, and how at one point valuations will matter. And it seems like as we rolled into 2025, they started to matter more. And then as things escalated, yeah, we've seen a rotation out of the tech leadership, the Mag 7, and into a wider breadth of companies. But there is so much uncertainty with the tariffs. You're on a lot of different conference calls and quarterly earnings reports with companies. And it's interesting what we're seeing as far as guidance, or sometimes no guidance at all with relation to the tariffs, and in particular, how it's impacted not just the mega corporations, but also the small to mid-sized companies. So maybe dig in on that front and what you're seeing when you sit in on a lot of these calls or when you read the transcripts. What is the trend as far as guidance for the rest of this year from the middle America and the mid and small cap companies?
Well, those companies that are giving guidance, they're widening the ranges of their guidance. They're almost doing sort of scenario planning. I think it was United Airlines early on in the earnings season saying that, under current economic circumstances, we can make between A and B, but if the economic downturn is more pronounced, we'll make between C and D. You've had other companies that have just not even bothered to give any guidance. Because why lay themselves out there not knowing how this plays out? And then, there's some companies that are maybe less exposed, but still acknowledging the risks out there. And I've heard plenty of companies that say, our guidance, we're giving guidance, but the guidance does not assume further economic weakening from here. So there are a lot of caveats out there, and companies are trying to figure it all out and doing their best to manage it. But obviously small companies just don't have that same flexibility. And when we say small, well, small can be defined in many ways. Real small, legitimately small, maybe those companies with less than 50 employees. And that's how sort of ADP, when they report their monthly jobs data, and they define small businesses as that under 50 and very small under 25. If you're in that sort of range of business and you've sourced in China and continue to, well, who knows if you'll even make it through this? Because while US leadership, Bessent and Jamieson Greer, are meeting with one of the top Chinese trade officials this weekend, who knows where this will lead? And even if tariffs get cut to call it 50% from 145%, I don't think many businesses can even survive a 50% tariff. So there's a lot of sort of things to power through here in terms of gaining clarity. And just I feel for these small businesses that are subject to this. I've been trying to point out to people that I understand. And I share the sympathy of the concerns of how trade has gone with China in terms of US manufacturing losing jobs to China. But a lot of that has to do with just lower valued stuff that was going to naturally transition out of the US anyway. as just lower cost ways of doing business in outside of the US were taking place, like in apparel and toys, for example. But China took our market share because, yes, they had lower costs, but because they were also very good at what they did. And but I also share the sympathy of, well, they've stolen technology from us, then IP and so on. I get that, and it's terrible. But you know, the history of business, unfortunately, is fraught with stolen IP. You know, the US was stealing IP from the Brits in the 1700s. You know, Steve Jobs went into Xerox PARC and stole the idea for the mouse. So it happens, and I get it, but to throw US supply chains in disarray over that, I think there were other better ways of managing that. But, you know, the stories I hear on a daily basis of, you know, I don't know if I'm going to make it through this because of my reliance on certain things from China, you know, really concerns me. And not only for those businesses, but, you know, the broader ramifications because we rely so heavily on small business.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Peter. And that's what we keep on hearing, right? Is that some of these large companies like Apple, they can go to the president and we see the sort of concessions that they get. Even the car manufacturers, these larger companies, they have access. The smaller companies do not, and that makes it very difficult for them. But also your point on why China became such a major producer of a lot of the goods, or at least some of the goods that the US buys. That's just the way the world has gone. And I feel like the US citizens have benefited from this agreement as well. They had cheaper goods. Quite frankly, Americans are very much consumer focused, and China filled that void. But Peter, do you understand what the end game is here? How the world could, I guess, get remade after Trump is done with these tariffs, whenever that might be? Because we hear it's about onshoring manufacturing, but all we heard from Apple was that they're moving manufacturing to India from China. So we're not necessarily seeing all these warehouses and manufacturing hubs being built in the US. What is the end game here in your eyes?
Well, apparently there's not any one end game. I mean, just look at the UK deal, which is more right now a letter of intent, as the actual deal is not done yet. The US has a trade surplus in goods with the UK. So I'm not sure why we still are leaving a 10% tariff on them. So it's not about reshoring with the UK. It's really more about knocking down some trade barriers, which I applaud, but with the 10% tariff still staying in place, it's more of a money grab instead, or I should say, in addition to. So there are a few different things there. If you talk to Peter Navarro, you know, he wants to vertically integrate all of US manufacturing. You know, he said on CNBC a couple weeks ago, I don't want to just assemble cars here. I want to make the transmission. I want to make the engines. I want to make the tires. Well, okay, on paper it sounds great. We're going to make everything about a car in the US. Problem is that the cost of that product is going to be so high that there aren't going to be many Americans that are going to be able to afford it. And you can say, you can forget being able to export that auto in a cost competitive way. So what will happen is a US car manufacturer, instead of making cars here for, yes, the domestic market, but then selling them overseas, well, you're not going to be able to compete. So what you'll do is you want to sell cars in Europe, you'll just build a plant in Europe and source your products around the world, ex-US, and sell those cars there. So not one US manufacturing job will be created for the export market. And in fact, you'll see a collapse in exports because we won't be able to compete with other parts of the world. So I don't understand his thought process. He's thinking very linearly and not understanding that we live in a non-linear world and not really fully connecting all the dots. With China, I understand the desire to protect US IP and maybe open up more of their markets for our products. I get that. But I don't get, like I said, tariffing, you know, the model train set business in the US in order to achieve that, or tariffing the imports of socks. I don't know how you get to an IP agreement from that. So I don't think it's clear what the end game is. I think One of the problems is the administration and Trump are working off a false premise that a country you have a trade deficit with is ripping you off and basically stealing money from you. It's nonsensical. So for all these reasons, I understand some of the purpose. We lost U.S. manufacturing jobs over the years, but as a percentage of U.S. private sector payroll employment, we've been losing them for 75 years since World War II. And that's because of production efficiency and automation and so on. And just, the US just had a higher cost structure than other countries. But, when you have a few thousand dollar per capita income, you're going to have lower wages. You're going to be able to compete in different ways. But that's what the world is all about. Not everybody runs their country in the same way. Countries like to protect certain industries, whether we like it or not. I mean, look, the US government essentially finances most of the US residential housing market. We subsidize it. This is just, and it just happens. We can try to level the playing field and lower trade barriers. No doubt we can compete as well as we can in certain things, and other things we're not going to be able to. But just the approach and the view on trade that somehow it's a zero-sum game, and also leaving out the huge trade surplus the US has in services with the rest of the world, like somehow that's forgiven. And are we ripping off other countries because we have a trade surplus in services with them? So it's all very unstable, chaotic, and I don't fully get. So I'm not sure what the end game is. I don't know where tariffs come out in terms of rates, but I do know that the tariff rate at the end of the day, if the 10% baseline stays online, that we're going to have the highest tariff rates in many decades. To what benefit, I'm not sure.
Yeah, Peter, it's such a complicated mix of factors right now. And if we were talking to you just even a couple of weeks ago, all we heard in the media was cries of, hey, it's really the end of the world in financial terms. And we were hearing that not just was there uncertainty, but that we're going into recession, maybe another Great Depression. And then the stocks had really tanked. The only thing that was really holding up was gold as a safe haven. Even bonds and the US dollar hadn't held up that well. But then over the last couple of weeks, we've seen a reversal of fortune where the dollar's picked up a little bit, bonds have got a little bit, but amazingly, the stock market has shrugged off all of this news that they were worried about a couple of weeks ago and blasted up to higher levels. How are you balancing out the volatility in the markets with the expectations of a financial contraction?
I think, the markets rallied back, I think, on the hopes and the beliefs that, well, it really started with April 9th when the reciprocal tariffs ex-China were delayed for 90 days. That's what sort of got this going. And then the belief that, we would have these big, beautiful deals and everything would be fine. But I think that the UK deal showed us that even if you have a trade surplus with us, even if you're one of our closest long-term allies, we're still going to slap a 10% tariff on you. Now, the market obviously doesn't care about that today, the day we're taping this, but I think it will at the end of the day, and that we're not going back to where we were before April 2nd. And yeah, we've had the extra steel and aluminum and auto tariffs, which I don't think are going to do anything any good. So I just think that there's just a level of optimism that things are going to be just fine. But, in a way, the S&P at about 5,700, we were 5,670. One on the April 2nd close, minutes before that Rose Garden reciprocal tariff announcement. So to me, around these levels, we're still down obviously from the highs. But yeah, I think it's hopes that everything's going to end up being just fine. And I wish we were. I think that a lot has changed and a lot of big picture things have changed. And foreign flows into US assets, that trajectory has changed. And there's less money, not only less money coming into the US, there's more money coming out. And like I said, the Mag 7 trade is done. So I think a lot of big picture things have changed. The government spending is not going to be the same level of GDP boost as it was. We saw that in Q1. So big picture things are changing here. So I'm circumspect of rallies. Where it plays out, excuse me, potentially on the downside, I don't know. But I think that helps to explain this sort of, wide volatility that we're seeing, and with now on the upside to that.
That also ties into this narrative that we are hearing a lot of, is this sell the US, money exiting the US, whether it's going into international markets in terms of European markets have been outperforming US markets, or even going into precious metals as a safe haven, gold, especially. We're seeing the dollar broadly lower. We're seeing bonds. Those aren't the same safe haven bid that we have seen in the past. And again, markets, yes, they're volatile, they're off their highs, but doesn't seem like there's that international flows in terms of money. So, Peter, is this part of that whole narrative that could be longer lasting, or again, is this just temporary?
No, I think it's potentially longer lasting because I think, and I'm going to sort of again try to tie things together here. The Mag 7 trade has been a global trade. It wasn't just a benefit to institutional and domestic and retail investors. It was a global trade. It was a global reserve asset for many international investors, both private sector international investors and public sector. Public sector, where the central banks like Swiss National Bank and the Norwegian Central Bank had big positions in US stocks. And I am very curious to see the updated 13 DNF filings, last updated December 31st and newly updated soon as of March 31st to see, and that's before April 2nd, of course, of these fund flows and to what extent foreigners have been trimming back. And I have to believe in April, they probably early April, at least they trim back some more. So I do think that if they're going to trim back the Mag 7 trade, well, the US markets, in terms of big, liquid, dominant names, are just less attractive. There are other things to buy in the US, but I think it opens up a whole world of other investing opportunities and not just US tech stocks.
Well, Peter, to that point, a lot of people were claiming a year or two ago that U.S. tech stocks were safe havens. Obviously, we've seen in 2025 that's clearly not the case, but the concept of safe havens has come back into the mainstream ideologue again. And the question I have for you is, bonds didn't really react like a safe haven this year, neither did the U.S. dollar. Gold held up well. Bitcoin's kind of all over the place. If we do see a downturn in the stock market rally and some of the air comes back out of this recent enthusiasm, and we do see a market contraction, where is the safety play? Where do you go for a safe haven?
Well, gold certainly has proven to be one of those, but the thing with gold is that is it a are people buying it for a safe haven or they're buying it because they legitimately want gold a bigger percentage of their reserve asset holdings because they just want to own less dollars. Now, they can say that as for safety reasons or just they are reassessing their view of holding, X amount of dollars in their portfolio. When it comes to safety in terms of not losing money in nominal terms, nothing beats that T-bill. But yes, you can bucket gold into that safe haven trade, but I never want to say, okay, the world's chaotic by gold. Gold has its own unique characteristics and why people want to buy it. And it's really becoming this global reserve asset that people feel like they need to get their hands on.
What has been your take on the money flows into gold balanced by central bank buying, also inflows into the ETFs, Western investment? It seems like kind of all around the world, people are investing in gold, especially through the ETFs.
Well, what was most interesting, of course, as we all know, was the response post the Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the freezing of half of Russia's central bank reserves and how quickly foreign central banks responded to that by ferociously buying gold over the last 3 years. Only recently, we're now beginning to see increases in gold ETFs as maybe Western investors are realizing the importance of owning gold. So there's certainly been a rethink, but when you think about this gold bull market, it's been going on for 25 years now, obviously interrupted by an almost 50% correction in the mid 2010s that bottomed in 2015. But when you look at certainly gold relative to the S&P, it's outperformed it. This sort of last leg up in gold is for the reasons stated since 2022, but there's been plenty of reasons to own gold, whether it was the central bank experiment with zero rates and negative rates and QE and so on us gold bulls have been given plenty of reasons to own it. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. It will change at some point. There will be a time when at least a portion of your portfolio in the metals will be due for a sell-off or a correction, or that doesn't bounce back and maybe an end to this bull market. I don't think we're there yet, but we will at some point. And hopefully we're smart enough to take those chips off the table, putting aside, the gold that some of us want to hold forever.
Well, Peter, gold's a unique asset in that it's considered a commodity, but it's really considered a currency of last resort. It's considered a monetary asset and it's held by central banks. But when you look at the rest of the commodity sector, it's very much dependent on supply and demand. So when you look at what's happened in oil, still, as we record this, just barely down below 60, bouncing back a little bit, but it's tanked over the last month or two. When you look at what's happened in base metals, not a lot of traction there. Even some of the soft commodities and food commodities are not really rallying. And that also depends on China, the mouth of the world, to also keep importing a lot of these commodities. With so many trade tensions with China and calls for an economic contraction, how are you looking at the commodity sector broadly?
All right, so sort of breaking that down, yeah, you take ag, for example, corn and soybean prices are still pretty depressed. Interestingly enough, the fertilizer stocks have sort of gotten some life. We've been bullish and long those names. Uranium on a spot basis has pulled back, but term premiums are still pretty good. The industrial metals, obviously, there's this push and pull between worries about the demand side with economic activity, but on the other hand, the global need and desire and sort of emergency for some to get their hands on these crucial materials if we're moving into this very sort of unbalanced by multipolar world where we have copper prices that even with these economic concerns is still hanging in there. Natural gas prices have traded pretty well, but oil prices have not. I think crude oil at WTI at $60 is dirt cheap. I think what was interesting was the Diamondback Energy earnings call a couple of days ago, where the CEO basically said, you're going to see a decline now in U.S. shale production, and not just because oil prices are low, but also the geology challenges, which is pretty interesting. And that's where you have low prices curing low prices, where U.S. production cuts would offset the increase that OPEC has announced. I think on the silver side, corollary to gold, that it's trading pretty well. And, we still have a bull market left to the upside in silver at some point. Platinum is one of the names, one of the commodities that we've bought most recently in late last year that I still think is half its value of about 14 years ago. And that hybrid vehicles are winning the sort of VHS Betamax war against full-on EVs, and catalytic converters are still going to be needed, and the demand for platinum will still be needed. But I think overall, as an asset class, I think one, it's going to come into more favor as, getting back to my theme of the Mag 7 trade being lost, that investors are going to search out other values. And I think in the commodity space, particularly, throwing gold miners there, and I know we all know that well, that value opportunities around the world are going to become more in fashion, and commodities sort of fit that bill.
All right, Peter. Thank you again for this really wide-ranging discussion on where the economy and where the markets lie. It's so important right now, but also impossible to know how this is all going to play out. But when you're an active investor, it is important to be positioned, especially when we could be seeing some major changes in leadership and in money flows, changes that really could upset what has been the standard for decades now. Again, we don't know how this is going to play out, but boy, boy, a lot is happening this year, and it's hard to keep a handle on exactly what's happening to it all. But again, that's why I like reading over your book report on Substack that you send out multiple times a day, covering different data points and market moves. So, Peter, great having you on the show. Again, Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group. Peter, we're going to chat again probably in a month or two time. And everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back again, continuing this focus broadly on what's going on in the economy and in the market.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate having me on.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.